Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, do we have a great story behind this book today. It is so exciting. I am so happy to welcome Amanda Flower, USA Today bestselling author and Agatha Award-winning author, to Joy on Paper because I love this book, To Slip the Bonds of Earth, a riveting mystery based on a true history. Hi, are you there, Amanda?
Yes, hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, Amanda, oh, you must have had so much fun with this book.
I did, it was so much fun to write.
Wow, now, of course, you've written 35 books, so...
Yeah.
So, I guess it comes easy. Well, it's never easy, is it?
Right.
But this one, of course, it is based on the sister of the Wright brothers, somebody we didn't hear too much about before, but now we're going to hear a lot about, because this is book one, and what I predict is going to be a long series.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
Well, I love it. You've done so... You take it, it's like you're just jumping in one of those spinning time machines and you go back and back and back, and then we land up right there in December 1903, and you create the atmosphere, everything is just right. And of course, you had a wonderful character to deal with, didn't you, to make her come back to life.
Yes, Catherine Wright was like such a fascinating woman in her own right. And the more I learned about her, I was like, oh my gosh, there's just so much material to write about with her.
So I don't know, did you come out with the idea or did your editor?
So I did. My publisher asked me, I had written a mystery series about Emily Dickinson.
Oh, I know, it's wonderful.
Oh, thank you. And they asked me to write another historical involving a real woman. And I wanted to, I'm from Ohio, so I wanted to highlight someone from Ohio. And so I was looking through, you know, all the famous Ohioans over in the, you know, turn of the 20th century. And of course, the Wright brothers are at the top of the list. And I was like, oh, I wonder if they had like a relative, like a sister or cousin or someone that, you know, was involved somehow. And then I learned about Catherine and found out she was very, very much involved.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She was, like, amazing. She was the only one that went to Oberlin College. She was the only one to graduate from college. And she was a suffragette later in life. She was just really an amazing person.
Well, in this case, you know, there's always a woman behind a man, and she was behind both of them because they never did get married, so she was very important in their life. And she is so fascinating. The research for this book must have been a pure joy.
It was, and since I was in Ohio, I'm closer to Cleveland than Dayton, so it's like 3 hours apart, but I was able to go there often enough. There's lots of museums there. There's a national park site dedicated to the Wright. So I got to kind of walk where they walked. See, their actual house was moved by Henry Ford to his museum in Greenfield Village up in Michigan. So I got to see his house, their shop, and then most of their papers have been digitized by the Library of Congress, including Catherine's letters, so I could just get online and read letters that she actually wrote to kind of hear her voice. So that, it was fantastic.
Well, my husband was a pilot. And so we've been to every, I think we've been to every museum that has anything to do with flying. And of course, we've been there, we've been to all the museums, and I'm from Michigan, and I've been to Deerfield, and so I've been there too. So everything, it was like, it was really, this was meant to be, and that you would get this idea, because as you said, you're from Ohio, so it's just like, it's so perfect.
Yeah, I'm really honored to get the chance to write about her, because I, you know, I wish I could have met her. I feel like we would be very close friends. There's a lot of similarities between us, so.
Well, of course, love of education, love of reading.
Yes.
Tell us more about it. Now, of course, she was teaching Latin. Did you take Latin in school?
I didn't. But, yeah, she taught Latin and she wanted to teach Greek, but she kept getting turned down because she was a woman. So that's kind of how the book opens. But I worked at a college for a long time, so she was very involved with Overland College Alumni Association. And then there's, you know, other things about our personal life that are similar. So I spent a lot of time taking care of family like she did. And so I really appreciated her for that.
Well, you just captured her. And I think it is exactly because you have similar interests and the story about how she gave up her career to take care of her brother when he was, most people don't realize, he was badly injured in one of the test flights.
Yes, and I hope we get to that. That happened around 1908, so I'm really hoping we get that far in the series because she did give up a lot and nurse Orville back to health. She went to D.C. where he had crashed, and it was a pretty horrific crash.
Well, so when you started the story, you know, it's always fun to look at it. Here you have the idea for the story, and you pick a specific day or time to start it. What was that process for you? I mean, that's so exciting when you get an idea, isn't it?
It is. So for this one, I knew that the boys, that's what Catherine called her brothers, even though she was younger than them. I know they sent a telegram home to her and her father on the day they flew for the first time. So I knew getting that telegram would be the perfect start because it changed not only their lives, but like the whole future of the world, essentially. So I knew to start that. And then the second book, which will come out next year, Catherine goes to the World's Fair in St. Louis by herself and meets up with a friend there. And it just shows how spunky and independent she was. She wants to see the World's Fair. She's going to go.
Exactly. I mean, for a woman at that time to do something on her own, just say, I'm going to do it. It's, it just makes her so fascinating. And I just love that you've brought her to life. It's just,
thank you.
For me, it's so exciting. You know, of course, we've heard over and over about the Wright brothers and everything. I love that you mention again, you know, it was 57 second flight. Everything turned, I mean, 57 seconds. It's boggles the mind when you think about it.
Yes. I mean, it was incredible. And then by the end of 1904, they were doing like an hour long flights over Huffman Prairie and Dayton. And like, they just had to get that wing warping aspect to click. And then, you know, they were off running.
Now for your research, of course, you mentioned I love that the acknowledgments are in the beginning of the book. Higgins Clark was on my program many times, and she always said that when she started doing that, putting the acknowledgments at the front, at first the publisher said, well, you can't put them at the front. You know, they belong in the back. And she said, no. The people who helped me to get to this point, they deserve to be up front. And so I love that you have that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I had a lot of help in regards to the research with this book. I think I named the museums I went to and people that helped me with the editing process, too. And it's just everyone's been fantastic.
And, of course, the book that really gave you a lot of the background of the Orville brothers, because I love David McCullough's book.
Yes, It is a fantastic book. I read it, and then I also listened to an audio, and he reads the audio, which is so fun.
I know. I love it. I love it. I think yeah. I listened to that. As I said, because my husband, you know, was a pilot. We spent so many years traveling around to different airplane museums, and of course we lived in England for a long time, so we went to every RAF base there.
Yeah,
and we flew. He was a pilot, so we had a small plane, so we flew all over the place. And
awesome.
Love that. That is one of the best Audible books. It's just fantastic.
Yes, and he's so I wish, you know, he's passed away now, but oh my goodness. I wish I had got a chance to meet him and thank him for his book. Because was so informative. Like, it really was my jumping off point to really understand the family. And then I went deeper into, first person, research from their letters and stuff. But it gave me such a nice, broad overview. Are you still there?
Yeah. Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I was going to say, the magical... it's called A Magical Bookshop Mystery Series. That series is so much fun.
Oh, thank you.
First, I love all the titles. I don't know who comes out with those titles, but they are so great. And pros and cons.
Yes.
I got such a kick out of that one. It's just absolutely, and there's another one called Verse and Vengeance. And I can remember, it's funny, I can remember the titles of that series.
Thank you. Yeah, I love those books, and they're probably it's probably my most popular series for sure. People love those.
Well, so now, of course, now that you know how to write a series, how to keep it all going, what's your process for actually, laying it out in advance? Now, of course, you probably lay out your series a little bit more in advance than when you first started. I don't know if you knew that you were going to have so many books.
Right. I haven't changed my process that much. Typically, I have a three-book arc, because most mystery series are bought in three-book groups. So I know there'll be at least three books, and I know where the main character will start and where they'll kind of end. Over that three books. But other than that, I'm pretty much a pantser, where I write by the seat of my pants. So I sit down, I start writing, and kind of figure it out with my amateur sleuth.
And what have you ever found that, are there certain words that you use over and over that are favorite words?
I use the word "that" a lot, I think, because it's part of Midwestern speech. So when it's not necessarily needed. So after I finish a book, before I turn it in, I go use the control find thing and look for "that" throughout to make sure I didn't have a bunch of extra "that's" in there. So little fill-in words like that I'll look for to make sure I'm not, you know, just being wordy, that every word counts and matters in the story.
I can't imagine, I was talking recently to a writer at an event, and they were talking about, being blocked, having writer's block. And for me, I can't imagine being blocked, because I could write all day long if I had the time. And, I can't imagine you having writer's block. Your mind is so full of characters. You go from one to another. It's just, I would just love to peek into that head of yours.
Oh, I'm probably not, because it's very crowded. So many thoughts. But no, I've never had writer's block either. I definitely get stuck now and again in a story, but I'll just, if I can't figure out what's going on in chapter, but I know it's going to happen maybe three or four chapters later, I'll go write what I know at that moment and then come back and fix the problem once my thoughts have cleared.
Well, of course, in writing a mystery, you have to have clues. You have to know that there's going to be some kind of a murder, and we have a murder to slip the bonds of Earth. We have a riveting murder, actually. Do you go back and plant some extra red herrings for people just to sort of make some twists and turns in your writing?
Yeah. So what I start with, I write like a fast draft, which is pretty slim on details, but it really gets the plot down. And once I know what the plot is, I'm like, okay, how do I trick people that are reading this to think it's someone else, but also have it make sense that when they get to the end and find out who the culprit is, that they're not like, that wasn't fair. So my mysteries are amateur sleuths and like fair play mysteries. So you could figure it out if you picked up all the clues along the way. But my hope is that you don't, that you're surprised.
Well, I think, you know, it was funny in the first, I think the first of your books, the Magical Bookshop. Mm-hmm. First of all, I read any books that are about bookshops because I love bookshops.
Yeah.
I had a little tiny little bookshop once. And so I love bookshops. Valerie Burns, who is another Kensington author, writes, mm-hmm. She has a bookshop in hers. So I love bookshop mysteries. And I think it was in Crimes and Poetry. One of them, I know that you had some really good red herrings and I didn't catch it. And usually, you know, I catch I'm pretty good at catching.
Oh, that's good.
So, you know, it's just, I get a kick out of an author who's just having fun because it's just, well, wonderful. And of course, now your very first thing that you got paid for, what was the very first thing you wrote that you actually got money for?
It was my first novel, Maid of Murder, which came out in 2010. And that was just like, I think I got paid like $1,000 and I thought this was like the best thing ever in the world. And, it was a true dream come true to know that I was going to have a book out.
And it is just, you have, you know, now with the, of course, Kensington, you have wonderful covers and it's just so wonderful. I have to just say thank you, Larissa, Larissa Ackerman, for sending me your books. I had one during the pandemic, but I was like, I missed a lot of shows. It was a crazy time. And I didn't get to do the Emily Dickinson one, but, it's just a thrill when I get an author like you. I think you're having a lot of fun.
I am. I feel so lucky to do this for a living and just write stories. I mean, they're murder mysteries, but ultimately I just want to make people happy and entertain them and just give them a little bit of joy.
Well, I'm glad you use that word because I think that is exactly what you do. You give them joy. For a little while, they can go into your world. And now, of course, they can go back into the early 1900s. And you need that. People need that. They need that kind of some, especially in these troubled times, a break from reality sometimes is refreshing. And certainly this one, To Slip the Bonds of Earth, really the wonderful, wonderful Catherine Wright mystery series that is just beginning, and we're going to have a lot more of them. It's a wonderful series, and I think that you've done a great job in bringing this to life. One of the things I want to ask, now, when you got your Agatha Award, what was that like? That's pretty exciting. For any author.
Yeah, it was so exciting. So I've won twice. Once I won for children's mystery years ago, and then last year I won for Because I Could Not Stop for Death, the first Emily Dickinson mystery for Best Historical Mystery. And I was just completely shocked. My speech was probably crazy, and like, because I was just, I didn't expect it. And it was a very surreal moment, because it's like at an awards show you see at TV, you don't know. So you're eating dinner, and then they start the awards and announce the name of the winner. And it was just, it was crazy. And I was so grateful. And then the second book that came out this past year, I Heard a Fly Buzz When I Died, is also nominated for Best Historical. And I don't expect to win twice in a row, but I'm excited that I get to go again in a couple weeks and just celebrate with all the other great books that came out last year.
Well, I'm glad you won for the Emily Dickinson one. It's sort of like a little, first, it's a great book, but it's also a little bit of a nod to Emily. She didn't win any awards.
Yes, I know.
You know, so it's sort of like she's looking over your shoulder and saying, good job.
Yeah. It's another fascinating, real woman for sure. So, and I adore Emily Dickinson. So I always have.
Oh, I do too. And it's nice. I'm glad you said real too, because one of the things that, you know, I now have a YouTube channel, Joy on Paper Live. And one of the reasons I started it, I just started it on St. Patrick's Day, was that because of AI, I want readers to see and actually understand that there are real writers behind all these books.
Yes.
And that you work very hard. You have this passion. And as you said, the joy. So I hope maybe you'd be a guest on my YouTube channel, because I think my viewers would just love to hear more about all of the books that you've done, all of your series. But right now, they can go ahead and get to Slip the Bonds of Earth. It's a great read, a really great read. And I want to thank you so much, Amanda Flower, for being a guest on Joy on Paper.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Thank you. You are a joy. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, great. We're going to have some commercials, and then I will be back, and I have a very fascinating guest.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Looking for inspiration? Looking for something that will intrigue you? Then this book is for you. Jim Lamb's poems start out as caterpillars, creepy, crawly, and raw. Then a miracle happens as they transform into colorful, bright, and conspicuous works of art. You can find Jim's new book of poetry, Hurting Butterflies, at Amazon.com. It's the perfect gift for the book lover in your life, even if it's you. Hurting Butterflies, the perfect holiday gift, available on Amazon. Get Hurting Butterflies.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back. And I'm just waiting for my guest, and this is going to be a fun interview. It's about schools. Oh, I have this love-hate thing with schools. But anyway, we will be talking to her in a little while, I hope. And then, meanwhile, I will talk about the Joy on Paper live YouTube station. And I'm having lots of fun with that. And so what I'm doing is when I have somebody on the radio and I think that they have a bigger story to tell, I'm going to invite them on the live program so that we can have more information about them. So anyway, well, we'll see what happens. I hope she calls in. I hope everybody watched the eclipse yesterday and that you got to see some of it. I did. It was fascinating. Wow. What a thing. So I'm just waiting. I don't know. These things happen. We will see. It's called the magical place we call school, and I'm hoping she will call in any minute. Any minute. And what else? I have so many things. I've been so busy since St. Patrick's Day, what with the opening of Joy on Paper Live and doing all of that. And I've had what I'm doing. It's just so much fun. I'm going through, you know, I celebrated the 9th anniversary on Joy on Paper. And of course, I've had many guests have been, you know, on the program more than once. Because, you know, they keep writing books like Carol J. Perry. My goodness, I started with book one and in one series, her Witch City series, and she's been going like that very energetic bunny, writing, and she's up to book 15 in the Witch City Mysteries, and she's up to she's working on book 4 in the Haunted Haven Mystery Series, and I just did a little commercial for her in my Joy on Paper Live program on Sunday. I hope that she had a look at it. But, you know, that's the fun of this whole thing of being associated with writers. So what I decided to do, I'm going back all the way back to 2015, to the beginning of the program, and I'm inviting all of the writers whose books I absolutely love. I always love the books that I'm talking about because I wouldn't have them on if I didn't love them. And now I am so happy to welcome Dr. Kathleen Corley, and her book is called The Magical Place We Call School, Creating a Safe Space for Learning and Happiness in a Challenging World. Dr. Corley, are you there?
I am.
Well, first I'm going to ask you a very serious question. Are you real?
Am I real? Yes.
You're a human being, right?
I'm quite real. I'm not a cyborg or something done on a hologram. I'm actually a person.
But, of course, you are in danger of perhaps being cloned. Somebody, look, one of those mystery workshops somewhere in Silicon Valley might just capture you and clone you. Because if you are as good as your book, they need to clone you. We need to have you all over the country.
Well, to be fair, I am surrounded by wonderful people. It makes being just a little bit better than adequate compensatory. That's the way it needs to be. So we lift each other up.
Well, yeah, but you're something special. And I must say, with your voice, you have such a fantastic voice. Not many authors can actually do their own audible. So you have a fantastic voice. And
oh, thank you.
Big Ed in the control room, would you play the opening I wanted to play for Dr. Corley? Okay, Big Ed, that's enough. I just wanted to get the idea in here. Is this school real? I mean, Red Cedar sure. Elementary School is a real school?
It is a real school. And there are other schools that are very much like us all over the country.
Wow.
People just don't know that they're there.
Well, they certainly don't, because until I read this book, I'd given up hope. It's amazing. Is it true? I don't know. I should have asked you to read the opening few lines of your book, because it's so beautifully done. But some of the things that you write about, miles of smiles, and I can see that. I love that you play an instrument, and the flute particularly, because I played the flute. So tell us why, what you're doing in the morning when school starts, and they play that call to post.
When they play that call to post, that's when the students can get out of their cars. They're usually lined up. They start lining up about 7 a.m., and at 7:15, we have people on duty to greet them. And so when the bell plays, when the system plays call to post, they get out of their cars and start coming into the building. They're greeted by a handful of people out in front. There are other people in the back who are greeting the children who are coming by bus. Sometimes I'm out front. More often than not, I'm inside and I'm playing some sort of instrument. On Tuesdays and Thursdays in the morning, we have a drum and dance team. This morning we played drums and did drums and flags because we march in parades. We have about 85, 90 students who are in that. So that cuts down a little bit on my time to play an instrument, whichever one I grab. And then there's also a young lady who's in fifth grade who doesn't speak very much English. When she came to us, she didn't speak any. She came last year as a fourth grader. She is, we've found, somewhat of a musical savant, and I'm not sure anybody knew that. But we play music together. We usually play the piano, and I'll play something, and she'll mimic it, and she'll make it better. So sometimes that happens, too. But music has incredible power over people. Just incredible. So if there's a way to get to someone, to get them interested in something, we're going to do it. And I majored in music. That was my undergrad, and it was voice. So I'm down for that.
Well, I'm a great believer in music, too. I think it motivates. It motivates me. There are songs that I play. Sometimes a polka in the morning, it gets me going. I love it. So I love that you're doing this. I don't know if somebody's made a movie about you and your school. If it's as good as you're writing about, they should, because they do movies about teachers all the time, but I haven't seen anything like this. So now explain what happens after the call to post and what's next.
Okay, the students go to class. I do the morning announcements, and I end with today the announcements had to do with we have this book vending machine that you probably read about, has these little gold coins, and we were looking for a way to determine who gets a gold coin, because it's worth something like maybe $10, $12 if they get a hardcover book out of the book vending machine. So it needs to be relatively special. So there were four students, that's a big number for today, who were honored today because someone, an adult usually, recommended them for having done something nice for someone to get a book. Like there was a boy, I call him Peter, in the book. There's a group of students who ride their bikes to school, and on the way to school, one of the children's bikes had a flat tire. It was a girl. So Peter said, "For on the way home, I'll take your bike, you take my bike, I'll take your bike to my house, my dad and I will fix your tire, then I'll ride your bike back to your house, and then I'll get my bike, and then I'll ride it back to my house. And I thought, that's a pretty spectacular thing to do, taking that upon yourself to help somebody out. So you announce the name, you say just what I just said, and this is why we're honoring Peter. So if you know that Peter's coming down the hall, you, if your teacher allows it, you might lean outside and say, "Way to go, Peter." And then they do hear applause. They walk down the hall like they just won the Olympics, and as well they should. And then we take a picture of them with us, with the book, and it goes on our social media, and their parents keep reposting it, and their grandparents get to see it, and that's the way it ought to be. That's the next thing that happens.
Yeah, that's the way it ought to be. This is not a private school. This is a public school, right?
Yeah, it's a public school. We're part of Beaufort County School District. Beaufort County covers Beaufort City and Port Royal and Hilton Head and Bluffton and Pritchardville and Okotoks.
South Carolina, for people who don't know. Now, we're going to step out. We're going to step back outside because I want to go back outside for a minute. I want to hear this description. I mean, this is too beautiful. Tell us about the apple pie and the picnic blanket. I mean, just, I wish I had, I should have had you read it yourself, but tell us how you visualize the opening of day, opening of school.
Are you talking about the apple pie and the red velvet cake?
No, not that story. We'll get to that one.
Okay.
No, here when they're walking into school. How do you describe them?
Describe them. That was describing them on the first day of school.
Well, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Describe that. I love it.
They are so ready to go, especially the kindergartners, which seems odd. Some of them cry, but more of their parents cry. Because as soon as they see the school, there are children who bolt into the school, wish to get to school, and we say, wait, did you say goodbye to Mom? Yeah, okay, goodbye. No, and then Mom's crying, like, oh, she can go to school all by herself, oh my gosh. But they can't wait to get back together, and it was especially that way after COVID. Our first opportunity to be back in school together, and to be reasonably close to each other. I think the rule was 6 feet at that time. We were ecstatic, and the children just thought they had died and gone to heaven because they were back with their friends, they were back with their teachers, and it was like a first day of school all over again.
Well, describe the image of if you were looking at them from above. Describe how you describe.
Oh, that's oh yeah. Ants at a picnic. I'm sorry. Yeah,
I love that. No, I want it all.
Sorry. Yes, they're just like ants at a picnic because they're all moving in the direction of what you might think would be the food if they were really ants, but they're not. So they're moving in the direction of where their classrooms are. So you see them in the parking lot. In front of the building, you see them coming off the buses in the back. And then if you could take the lid off the school, if you could take the roof off, you would see them making their way into their classrooms because they've come the Friday before with their parents, nearly all of them, to see where they're going to be in class. So everybody knows where they're going to be.
Now, you mentioned that they're wearing uniforms and they have miles of smiles. They're wearing uniforms or not?
Yes, they are wearing uniforms. It's a rule in the district, but some of us take it more seriously than others. That is, if the uniform is red, white, or yellow polo shirts, and a child wears a jacket over that says, I don't know, really doesn't matter what it says. Metallica, I'll go way back. Or Britney Spears or Taylor Swift or whatever, doesn't have to say anything. But if it's not our colors, well, why are we doing uniforms? So take your jacket off, hang it up. If you need a sweatshirt, a red one, a white one, a yellow one will be fine if they're plain, or a red spirit sweatshirt, which would have our logo on it with Foxy. Foxy is our mascot. In other words, keep the uniform thing going. And if they're supposed to tuck their shirts in, they tuck their shirts in. If they're supposed to have belts, they have belts. We tried belts in kindergarten. Bad idea. Wet cleanup aisle three. Because they don't plan well enough when they need to go to the bathroom. So we give them a little pass on kindergarten and first grade. It just saves wear and tear on the custodial staff.
I'm flabbergasted, really. When I started reading the book, and I didn't know. I'm going to tell you, I didn't know that schools like that existed. We don't see this in the news. I can tell you, we don't see this. We don't see them with smiles and smiles. And all the things that you do ahead of time, like getting them ready in the springtime and already preparing the students, and talk about this Tacopalooza. And then later on, you have a big event that involves all the students. Where did you come? Was all of this your idea? Because I've never heard of anybody having schools like this.
If you think about it, any business or any organization, a church, a radio station has to have some intentionality about what they're doing. After a little while, you learn to do things better than you did before. And remember, we have parents who have demands, requests, puzzlements. Sometimes they're engaged. Sometimes they're overly engaged. Some don't want to be engaged at all. And we need to make sure every student has a support system, and we like to start with parents, but we'll work around them if we absolutely positively have to. So if you're going to be intentional about everything you do, that doesn't mean it's a lockstep sort of thing, but we always want to have a reveal at the end of the year for what classes students are going into the next year. For some of them, it's no surprise because kindergarten and first grade teachers pair up. A kindergarten teacher works with a first grade teacher, and there's an assistant that they share. Okay, so the kindergartners in Mrs. Binkley's class are by design going to be first graders in Mrs. Howell's class because Mrs. Howell has been next door all year, and she knows those students just about as well as Mrs. Binkley does. So there's no surprise there. When they go to second grade, that's a surprise. It's in a different hallway, and they will know on Tacopalooza night, and I'll get to why it's like that in a second. But they go to their second grade classroom. But when they're going to third grade, they're not going anywhere. It's the same teacher who loops up with them second grade to third grade because we have fewer transitions that way, and fewer transitions are good at elementary level. Fourth to fifth grade, same thing. You with me so far?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I love it.
Tacopalooza is, if we can feed them, and it's rare that we can feed them anymore because the way our finances work and what we are allowed to spend money on, it's not so much the finances themselves, but if it looks like we're just feeding people all the time just for the heck of it, they're not going to let us do that. So Tacopalooza is generally funded from the outside somewhere. That's another intentional thing. We have an agenda book, which is basically an elongated calendar, has assignments in it, has special dates, tells you when to wear your spirit shirt, tells you when Tacopalooza is going to be, tells you that our spring break is next week, all of that. Well, those are sponsored by, they're expensive. They're about $6,000 to make enough for everybody in the school. Well, we have two law firms with children who go here. Their parents run the law firms. Hey, guys, are you interested in supporting that? Absolutely. Okay, we'll put you down for that. So we'll put your logo on the back of the book, and all will be right with the world. The taco thing is the taco thing because we need to reward the parents for coming through the line. This is almost insidious, this next part. We have to tell everybody every year about the Read to Succeed law in South Carolina, which says that if third graders taking the state test perform very poorly on the test, they will be retained, unless they're one of a couple of things that would change that. A student who has not been in the United States for more than 2 years would not be retained. A child with an individualized education plan and special needs would not be retained. A child who has already been retained would not be retained. So, at the door, we funnel people into classrooms so that they can hear a very short presentation, and we have English and Spanish classrooms just because it's faster that way rather than translating everything. So direct Spanish, direct English. And when they leave, they get a plate to put their tacos on, but nobody gets a taco until they listen to the presentation. That's the insidious part.
Oh, boy. Now, let's step
back
again.
But we need for them to hear it. We need for them to hear it, and we don't want them to be unhappy. So, okay, now you get tacos. Yay!
First of all, this law in South Carolina, is this in other states? Because we hear about so many states where kids are being moved from class to class to class until finally they're in 12th grade and they are reading at a 4th grade level.
Yes, you're talking about social promotion. That, I think, happens all kinds of places, but I think states have come to grips with the problem in a variety of ways, and I know that there are other states that do it this way, but South Carolina decided to do this at third grade because their determination is if you can't read well by third grade, you're going to have a significant problem in all the other grades because we like to say in kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade, you learn to read. Fourth and up, you read to learn because you're reading about other subjects then. You need to know how to read.
What a great concept. It's just so funny. It seems so logical, but it seems like I think there's a lot of places that don't quite get it. Now, did you ever teach third grade, by the way?
No, I taught music.
I
taught third graders. I taught pre-kindergartners through eighth graders.
Okay. So you mentioned third grade because I have a – here's where I come from. I had a terrible time in third grade, just terrible. I had a teacher who won we had just come from northern Michigan down to Detroit, and I'm left-handed, and she made me sit on my left hand. And then I wouldn't read out loud because when I was in third grade, by the time I was in third grade, I was reading Perry Mason paperback books. I mean, I could read. I could read at an event. I mean, I read over 10,000 books in my life. So at that age, I could read. And I wouldn't read out loud. And so she called me in front of everybody. She called me a dummy. Now, of course, I thought she meant, thinking back on it, I was thinking she meant stupid. But she must have known that I could read because, you know, But, of course, maybe she didn't know I could write because she wouldn't let me write. So it took 3 weeks before my father finally figured out there was something wrong, and he walked in and said, you know, by the way, Betsy can read anything you have in this school. You're so caring. I mean, your people around you instill this caring. I find this magical.
Well, part of it is what I instill, but a lot of it is by now there are people who know how we do things and they want to be a part of it because they are like-minded. So it's not like I've molded everybody in my image because they certainly are not, and that's a good thing. But they come to us wanting to be a part of what we do because they agree with the things that we do. Some of it is just common sense and taking care of little things and getting them out of the way of the teachers so they can work their magic.
Well, I'm running out of time. I want to just repeat the title of your book. It's called The Magical Place We Call School, and it is by Dr. Kathleen Corley. And I suggest to everybody that you get this book. If not, well, for many reasons. First, the cover is great. I love the cover, and you explain that in the book. I don't have time here, but it's really this creating. It's subtitled Creating a Safe Space for Learning and Happiness in a Challenging World. I think it should be really creating joy for learning and happiness in a challenging world, because what you're doing is joyful. I just thinking of you. Well, we're going to play a song. I have to talk to you more. Okay. Big Ed in the control room, would you play the song I want to play out? And Dr. Corley, thank you so much. I'm going to be in contact. I'm going to have you back, okay?
Okay.
And here's a song for you.
Yes.
Okay. This is for you, Dr. Corley. I love you.
Take care.
Okay, you too. You'll be back.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Cammie McCormick. We're awaiting sentencing in the Michigan trial.